chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, my family's favorite poet is Tony Abbott, a retired professor at Davidson College, and also the inspiration of many of the country's great writers. And he's not just a poet, he's an award-winning poet, and his most recent collection is If Words Could Save Us. And he's also a novelist, and he's the co-editor of another book called What Writers Do, which features Lee Smith, Fred Chappell, Jill McCorkle, many of our other favorite writers who visited the Lenore Ryan's Visiting Writer Series. Whew, a lot. But he's here to talk about both those books and about writing and about other things that might be on his mind. Tony Abbott, you got lots of fans up here in Chapel Hill, lots of friends and fans in Chapel Hill, but thanks for coming up to talk about these two books.
You're very welcome, D.G. I'm glad to be here, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. We go way back, and we have always enjoyed talking to one another, so thank you for having me.
Well, it's a treat. There are many things we could talk about, and maybe we can try to focus on the books. Well, which book are you more excited about? We'll talk about that one first.
Well, that's really not a fair question. Because I have to be more excited about my own book, but I'm very, very excited about What Writers Do also. So I can talk about my excitement about both books, but separately.
All right.
So which would you like to do first?
Well, I tell you what, so that you can talk dispassionately about it, although you are the co-editor of What Writers Do, and you've also written a nice introduction, and you've also have a poignant entry about your experience in with South Africa, all the way from Cry the Beloved Country to a visit to South Africa in modern times.
That's very important to me. Let me just tell you a little bit about What Writers Do, because it's a remarkable book. I think, first of all, it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. I think the design of it and the editing of it is astonishing. What Leslie Rindox has done as the editor of Lorimer Press, we've got these beautiful, beautiful pictures of all the writers, most of which were taken by David Crosby, who is the photographer at Lenore Ryan. We also have pictures of the writers' workspaces, and many of the workspaces are quite fascinating. A wonderful picture of Kathy Smith Bowers and her cat, and God, Joe Humphrey's workspace is like goes all the way back to the Civil War, and then the
she's got this workspace down in this little old Confederate veterans or widows house down in Charleston.
Exactly, it's a remarkable book. What happened is Rand Brandis, who is the head of the Visiting Writer Series at Lenore Ryan, asked me if I would edit this book, and I was very honored.
What was his plan to start with? When he talked to you about editing the book, what did you think it was going to be about?
He didn't have a plan.
What is his idea?
Here was the idea. The idea was to ask all the writers who had been to Lenore Ryan to submit something, and we split the writers in half. I took the writers I knew best, and Rand took the writers he knew best. He took the Irish writers. He took Billy Collins. He took Seamus Heaney. He took all the Irish poets. I took Lee Smith and Joe Humphreys because I knew them well, and Jill McCorkle and Fred Chappell. And so we split the writers up, and we thought for a while about the theme of the book.
Did it start out just sort of as an effort to kind of memorialize and document that Lenore Ryan had really been extraordinarily successful in gathering great writers and having them present programs for the community and for the student body.
That was going to be
a memorial edition
I don't want to say memorial because they're mostly still alive, but it was to document the Lenore Ryan Visiting Writers series and honor those writers who had been a part of it. And in the process, I think the Lenore Ryan Visiting Writers series is the best writer series in the state, and it's not as well known as it should be. And if you just look at the look at the cover and look at
I'm going to look at it, and we're going to talk about what it is. I'm talking about how it got...
What I'm saying, but the point is that we wanted to do this book, to put this writer's series out to the public mm-hmm. in a way that it had not been before, so it would become better known.
So it's not only to document and memorialize the experience, but also to reach out and say, hey, this is something that's going on
Absolutely.
That you might want to be a part of.
Absolutely.
To soften up prospective writers to say, hey, golly. They're doing something.
And prospective audiences, you know, readers. I mean, I think this is a great book for readers. So we talked about theme and
well, tell me about who was the first writer you approached, if you can remember. Who was the first writer you approached, and how did that work its way into being a part of the book? If you can't remember,
I would talk about Lee Smith because. Can I read you something?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to read you the last paragraph of my introduction because that really says everything that I wanted to say. I really am very, very proud of my introduction. Let's see if I can do this.
Well, I know you got it. It's got a separate copyright on it. We have permission to broadcast this.
Absolutely, you have my permission. So maybe I got what I asked for: poems, stories, essays that change people's lives. In an age when so much we read is either dreary or unintelligible, it is a joy to find a group of writers who can celebrate life and language and hope. They give us courage. They make us want to be the human beings we were intended to be. They make us want to use the language in new and better ways and to honor the dignity and power of the old ways. At the end of God's grandeur, Hopkins writes, there lives the dearest freshness deep down things. These writers have discovered that freshness, and they have passed it on to us as a gift. Now we must unwrap the present.
So that's the present. Now, I want you to do one thing for me, and then
yes,
and I want you to. Let's just take Lee Smith and see if you can reconstruct the telephone call or the letter in which you explained to her what happened, what you planned to do, and then how that worked into what she really gave.
What I wanted to do was to ask people to send me something that was life-changing. The theme was to be how writers change lives, how writers change our lives as readers, how writers change their own lives by writing. And so the first piece I asked for was Lee Smith's beautiful, beautiful tribute to her son, Josh.
Now, when you called her, get back into your mind.
I asked her on the telephone.
Did you call her on the phone or did you see her? Do you remember?
I didn't see her, but I mean, I had seen her. What happened was I read her piece about Josh. It was published in one of the papers. I don't know, the Independent.
Independent, probably, yeah.
And I wrote a review of Lee's book that she wrote right after that. And you'll have to—I can't remember the name of that book. It was about the girl in Virginia at the school.
On Agate Hill.
And I said that Lee was mourning— for her son, Josh, when she wrote that book. And she wrote me the most beautiful letter, and she said, Tony, you got that exactly right. And I was very touched. And Lee and I have always felt a sort of soul kinship. And in fact, Lee wrote one of the blurbs for my poetry book. So the minute that I got the job of editing What Writers
Do.
She was the first person you had in mind. You knew you had a framework for this, and I knew that I wanted that piece. And I can't remember whether I asked for it on the phone or I asked for it by email. I said, Lee, would you please, could I have the piece you wrote about Josh? Because it changed my life reading that piece. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. And I wanted it in the book, and she said yes. I mean, that right away. And then I went to.
Let me just stick with Lee because this your selection of this thing about Josh and then Lee's beautiful description of how the loss of her son fit in her life and that she, while mourning him, she celebrated what he had done for her life. So what was it about that essay that, well, I mean, you start crying when you think about it,
what you just said. I mean, I think that life is so precious.
First of all,
Lee and I had lost a daughter, and I had my whole writing career grew out of my need to celebrate her life and the preciousness of life. And she had done that in the Goodbye to the Sunset Man. And I was so touched by the way Josh was so loved in his community and what an impact he made. And
Tony, some of the folks who love Lee Smith, some of them don't know about this story about Josh. Can you just briefly
maybe you know it better than I do, but Josh was impaired from, I'm not quite sure what it was that he had. He had a particular form of mental illness, and he was prone to depression. He had managed it very well, and it seemed as if to me that he was managing it well and was a great blessing to people in this community and very much loved. And then he took his own life. Mm-hmm.
Well, or
unexpectedly,
yeah, or with the drug, as I understand it, a drug that he was taking for treatment of his
or he took
his
too
illness,
much
and,
of it,
and
or,
it was the wrong kind of dose.
But I don't. It was a terrible, terrible shock. I mean, I can't. You know, if I had known that we were going to talk about this, reread the story because all I can say is I was very deeply moved by how much, you know, how much Josh was loved. And it seemed to me that was the most important thing, to celebrate the preciousness of individual human beings. And I don't know a piece that does it any better. And I was just going to say one more thing because it's so closely related. The second person I went to was Josephine Humphreys. And
can we take a break and then talk about Josephine Humphreys? We're visiting with Tony Abbott, a poet, novelist, and now a co-editor of a book that's called What Writers Do. And we're visiting about that book as we talk about how writers write about things that change their lives. Tony Abbott and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tony Abbott. Tony is a retired, I mean, it's more dignified to say Professor Emeritus Davidson, but he's also an active poet. And a wonderful writer, to me, maybe even more important as the inspirer of others, always to do their best. And there are a number of great writers who credit their coming out as writers to Tony Abbott. But he's here talking about What Writers Do, a new book. And that book, if you joined us late, basically Tony has told us that it's a collection of material from writers from the Lenore Ryan Visiting Writers series, but aimed at having the writers describe life-changing moments. And we've talked before the break about Lee Smith's wonderful essay about her son, losing her son, Josh. And Tony, Josephine Humphreys is also a very popular writer around here. For me, mostly because of her wonderful book set in Lumbee Indian Country. But You got from her a story that had a relationship to the Lumbees that was a life changing moment for her.
Exactly, and in the case of Lee Smith, I asked for Goodbye to the Sunset Man. In Joe Humphrey's case, I asked her to write, and I said, Joe, have you ever written an essay about how you came to write Nowhere Else on Earth? And she said, no, but I've always wanted to. And so I said, would you do that for this book? And she said, yes, and she did. And she wrote the story, which I had heard her tell in lectures, about that train trip.
Tell it.
Where she found this, she was on the train going to Boston, I think, and when she was very young, and she there was this beautiful, beautiful girl, and I think and a sailor, wasn't it? Got on the train, and she started talking to Joe, and the girl who was strikingly beautiful said, "You know, I'm very worried that his family won't like me." And she said, "Why not?" And she said, "Because I'm an Indian." And she said, what are you? And she said, "I'm a Lumbee." And Joe had never heard of the Lumbee. She didn't know what that was. And so she learned about the Lumbee Indians from this particular experience on the train. And then later on, and she had always wanted to write about that and had not gotten to it for a long time until she finally began to do the research for Nowhere Else on Earth. And then she met this wonderful, wonderful woman. The title of the essay is Finding...
Yeah, this is Louise Maynard.
Louise Maynard. And so she met, and Louise Maynard, who was a Lumbee Indian, became her best friend. And that friendship grew out of her need to find out about the Lumbee experience. And so, in fact, it was the single, these two branches of this story, the experience on the train and finding Louise, was the most significant life-changing experience for Joe. I mean, she said the whole Lumbee experience was the most profound life-changing experience of her life. So this is not only a life-changing experience for the reader, but also for the writer.
Well, I love this story. I mean, there's another connection to Chapel Hill, in that Louise Maynard's daughter is on the faculty at University of North Carolina, teaching American Indian affairs. And the Maynard family connects the sort of Lumbee diaspora, but they are always back in Pembroke. Right. I mean, they're going back and forth all the time, and very, very loyal to their families, and have broadened that Lumbee experience. So the idea that almost by accident, Josephine Humphreys, who is fascinated by the Lumbees, comes up to Durham for a book club and runs into Louise Maynard, and they develop this long-term friendship that Josephine Humphreys, who's a famous writer for all kinds of other reasons, is in some communities now most known for this book.
Exactly. And that happens over and over and over. I mean, my own essay in this book was about South Africa, and I was extraordinarily moved by South Africa, and primarily moved, of course, by Nelson Mandela.
Well, I tell you what, on your essay, I mean, the great thing about writing is that that people who read things get moved by things that the author didn't. But your introduction to your essay is, as I remember it, is about when you were a young person reading Cry the Beloved Country.
By Alan Payton, yes.
And which is a book that moved many people back in those times. But part of it that I remember is that when you were asked in some scholarship interview or something, they said, "What are your two favorite novels?" You mentioned one of them, and you mentioned two. I can't remember the other, but one.
I think I'd say, "Well, who are your favorite 20th century British novelists?" And I said Joseph Conrad and Alan Payton. And the Examiners said, well, they didn't even know who Alan Payton was. I had obviously not picked somebody that was considered in the canon, you know.
Not in the canon. He was outside. He was in the Commonwealth rather than being. But this is a jar. First of all, I don't think it really jarred you, but it is a jar for young people when their favorite or something that's moved them is not even known to the next to the generation before them.
Well, it happens to the other way. It is very jarring to us to find that the young people today don't know any of the writers that we learned, because the people they read in school are often very, very different from the ones we read. So there is that generational difference, I loved Alan Payton. I was very, very, very moved by that book.
Let me just, and this is off the subject, but you grew up outside the South. Those of us who grew up in the South who were reading Alan Payton, it was a double poignancy in the sense that we were reading and identifying with the reform movement in South Africa because of writers like Alan Paton.
Which failed, you know, and then it was exactly at the time that Paton was writing that the Nationalist Party took over. And Paton wrote Cry the Beloved Country. I think it was in 1948 the Nationalist Party took over, and the apartheid lasted all the way up until 1990. You know, so it was a and Paton himself suffered gravely at the hands of the Nationalist government. And I think we don't. Yeah, I grew up outside the South, and I like that idea that there's a double poignancy.
Well, here we were being indirectly changed because, as we identified with the anti-apartheid movement and stories in Cry the Beloved Country and other work coming out of South Africa, we had to turn our face back to what we were doing here in the South, and it just— whose side are we going to be on? Are we going on the Afrikaner apartheid? Or are we on the side of the reforms? Well, at home we were on the side of the segregation. Yeah. So how to, you know, and so it had this.
And it's very similar because obviously the middle and upper class white people in South Africa were in the same position that the middle and upper class white people in the South were. They, you know, you. People are very reluctant to let go of what they have, even if they know it's right.
Well, we're not finished talking about your essay, but we do have to take a break. And we're visiting with Tony Abbott, talking about, right now we're talking about What Writers Do, which is a new book, and his essay in that book. We've got lots more to talk about, and we'll do that after this short break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tony Abbott. We're talking about a book that he's edited or co-edited, What Writers Do, featuring writers from the Lenore Ryan Bisting Writers series. And Tony, let's talk about your I kept interrupting you as you talked about your essay in this book, What Writers Do, as a life. This is a collection of writers' works that reflect, if not directly, but reflect their moments that changed their lives. Yeah. And you say South Africa changed your life.
Well, I had always wanted to go to South Africa, and we were never able to go, and we were able to go finally. And on this trip, on the way over on the plane, and during the weeks before, I read a 500 or 600 page biography of Nelson Mandela, and I also read an extraordinary book by Bishop Tutu. I want to say, I'm trying to, he was made by Mandela the chair of the Commission on Truth and Reconciliation. And what they did in South Africa without vengeance is to say to people, if you're willing to come forward and tell the truth, there will be forgiveness, because none of those people who suffered under apartheid had ever had a chance to tell their stories and have them believed. And so during this whole process, what moved me so deeply about Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu was that they were able to bring about a profound change in the world without violence and bloodshed. And it seems to me right now they're models that we desperately, desperately need in our world and in our time. And I was so moved by the genuine heroism of those people. And I hadn't really, you know, in 1968, you know, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, it was a moment where my heroes were gone. you know, it was and it's very, to me, Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu are heroic in that way. They bring to us something we desperately need as human beings. And I was so moved by their stories and being able to travel around South Africa and learn more about them and what they did, and going to Robben Island, where Mandela had been imprisoned for so many years, and seeing the cell where he actually was kept, and seeing the prison yard where he had written his autobiography and buried parts of it. You know, it was just extraordinary. I was very, very moved by the South African people, by their genuineness, by their desire to do some real good in the world, in a situation which is very, very, very difficult for them. We went to some of the townships. We saw the poverty. We saw the people working really hard to do something. So I was deeply moved by that experience, and I wanted to write about it.
And
anyway.
In your essay, you quote a poem that was important to Mandela. It's, you know, under the deep bludgeonings of fate, my head is bloody, but invictus.
Invictus.
And why? I mean, you used a whole half a page to.
Well, you know, the poem was used in the movie. What was the title of the? Wasn't that the title of the movie?
Nelson
Mandela and the soccer team.
Or the rugby team.
The rugby team. And how he wrote that poem out and gave it to the captain of the.
So it was the movie rather than a personal experience with Invictus that got your attention to that poem?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. It was the movie that got my attention. And then when we were on the trip, one of the people on the trip wrote the poem out and handed it to me. And I memorized it. And I recited it. To
you
the
can
group.
Still memorize poetry. You're not that old then.
I memorize a lot of poems. I mean, I do a lot of recitation. I can't do Invictus right now because I haven't practiced it in several months. But if you gave me one day, I could get it back. But I do a lot of memorization. I recited. I was very, very excited about that. And it turns out that Invictus was Mandela's favorite poem. You know, I am the captain of my fate. I am the master of my soul. No matter what they do to me, they can't destroy me. My head is bloody.
Thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable,
soul. Yeah. So it's a funny poem in that I was told by my teachers at Kent School, which was where I read Alan Payton, because Alan Payton came to Kent School when I was a student and spoke. And the headmaster said it was secular humanism, and we were a Christian school.
Bible. The poem or the book?
The poem.
The book.
So we were not Invictus supposed to like second. Invictus,
but you had to study it.
But we didn't. But then when I read it with Mandela, I had a completely different take on it, and I loved it because Mandela loved it. And in the movie, he hands the poem to the captain of the rugby team, which in fact in real life he didn't do, but it was his favorite poem, and he did recite it over and over while he was in prison, and it helped to keep his courage and his spirit.
Well, we're going to transition after this break to your poetry, and your poetry reflects a strong religious themes, and from that standpoint, as a poet who writes about religion without being a missionary or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Invictus a religious poem, or is it a secular humanist poem, as your headmaster said?
I prefer not to answer that question.
No, it isn't. We'll discuss it then.
It's a religious poem, but it's also saying, it doesn't say that only by the grace of God am I the captain of my soul. In fact, the Christian theology would say we're not the captains of our souls. We are not in charge of our own life. We cannot do anything without the grace of God. And that we are redeemed through through Jesus Christ. And there's nothing of that in that poem. I mean, I think what the poem seems to affirm is a late 19th century belief in progress, in hope, and in determination and courage, all of which is very wonderful. So it probably is, was probably written as a secular humanist poem. But secular humanism and Christianity aren't that far apart. They can be very close together if there's just one little difference. I mean, the Christianity itself is humanistic. It believes that our function as human beings is to love and serve one another and to make a better world through our lives. And the only big difference is that the humanist says that there's no God, essentially, and that we
or
just
whatever have, gods may
whatever
be,
whatever God may be, we have to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think the Christian says we do it only.
It keeps coming back. I think whatever gods may be. And is that a dismissive thing about God's
no,
or it could
I don't
be
think.
It could be I'm
I it think could be. It could
I,
be
I, I'm
it
just
could be
not
multiple
gonna,
gods
well or it could be I'm just not quite
sure.
Absolutely sure, but it's not dismissive necessarily.
No, I don't think it's dismissive. I mean, whatever gods may be is expressing doubt, and doubt is a part of faith. And
or in whatever gods may be,
we're
not going to argue about that right now.
We're not going to argue about that. No, I agree.
Well, we need to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about, not Invictus, we're going to talk about the poetry of my guest, Tony Abbott. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I've been visiting with, as I said, my family's favorite poet, Tony Abbott, and a favorite friend as well. We've been talking about, if you're joining us late, we've been talking first about what writers do. It's a book, a collection of essays by essays and poems and some fiction about events that changed the authors who visited the Lenore Ryan in the Lenore Ryan Visiting Writers series. It's a great book, and if you missed it, you can go to chapelboro.com and listen to it on the WCHL Who's Talking webpage. Tony, you're also out promoting your book, If Words Could Save Us, and this is a book of poetry. It's a book that is a collection of new and some of your earlier poetry. I don't want to say unusual, but it's noteworthy that this book is not only poetry, but it is also, to some extent, it's a narrative. I mean, it's a story. Tell us, and you're out promoting your book. This is on Wednesday, October 26th. You'll be at the Regulator bookstore talking about.
Regulator in Durham at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, so I'll be back up this way.
Tell us about your—
Well, you know, I love this book very much, and the first thing I want to say about the book is that people have always told me that I should do a CD because I read well, and so I did. And this book contains a CD.
I want to just stop you right there, and because this is a headline, in the sense that many of us who have trouble with poetry, mm-hmm. because we can't get the voices off the page.
Yes.
When we hear some poets, well, some poets aren't very good reading their poetry.
That's
but
true.
But some poets take those words off the page, and we're transformed as they read them. And so you're modestly acknowledging that people love to hear you read. And so as a part of the book, you get the CD, and you can hear the poetry.
His poetry is an oral form, really, it is. And then As we were talking earlier, I've memorized a lot of poems, and I'm working on memorizing poems from this book now, so that when I do readings, I do not only read the poems, but I recite some of the poems.
You're not reading the teleprompter.
It's coming from my soul.
This is not fair.
Can you do anything?
Can you just pick up anything out of the book?
Let me try to recite.
And if you mess up, nobody
knows. Recite the title poem. And you can watch me so that I'm not opening the book. I'll cheating.
I'll testify. Okay. He hadn't opened the book yet. Ooh.
If words could save us, and they can, my darling, I would whisper in the chambers of your ears every wistful sound like the warbling of the wood thrush until my wren, even the small boys whose voices are like angels would cry for more, and you, my swan, would sigh like the sun setting behind the ocean floor. If touch could save us, and it does, my dove, I would take the wounds of time and touch them all, until the soul, my sweetness, shines with the light of God in the newness of now. Healing is the only language of love, my lamb. For wherever we have touched, the tree that grows there will be blessed, my bliss. And the fruit of that tree will be life, my love. The fruit of that tree will be life.
Well, I want to testify that you didn't open your book. You didn't come close, and that's amazing. Now, talk to us, if you will, about the poem. Are you just going to leave us,
Let me tell you about the book, because when I was saying I made a CD, in the CD I have an introduction, and in the introduction I explain the structure of the book and the theme of the book. So if you want an answer to the question, you got to buy the book and then listen to the CD, and I'll tell you but basically this is a story. This book is divided into three parts. The first part is called Providence. The second part is called Ordinary Time. And the third part is called Grace. And what this story is the story of a life, any life, all life, perhaps. We are thrust out of Eden symbolically. If you don't believe in the Eden story, you do believe in coming of age. You believe that you grow up and you're thrust out into the world and you've got to manage on your own in Providence. You've got to manage. And all the poems in the first part are poems about growing up, coming of age, losing your innocence, having to deal with the real world. The second part, Ordinary Time, is about the real world and living in the real world. Some of the poems are satirical, some are political, some are funny, some are sad, and they're all poems about reality. The third part, Grace, is about redemption, about the transformation of reality by grace. You know, it's interesting that some people have read the book and said, well, it's about grace in old age. Well, not necessarily just old age. We go through this cycle more than once in our lives, the redemption of the ordinary by some moment of grace that transforms the ordinary into something remarkable or extraordinary or wonderful or beautiful. And you got to be there to have that happen. I've been reading a lot of Mary Oliver. I'm doing a course on Mary Oliver, and as she's a poet, she says, to be a writer, you got to do three things. You got to pay attention, be astonished, and then write about it. And what you're astonished by is that moment of grace. But you got to be there and feel it. How's that?
That's fantastic. But now, give it a moment of grace. I mean, what is a moment of grace?
A moment of grace is when you see something very lovely, very beautiful, very poignant, very extraordinary, and you recognize it as not just a thing, but as a kind of manifestation of the divine, of something spiritual through something physical.
Can you give us an illustration?
Well, you know, I have a poem called, I did a lot of poems based on the parables.
Yeah. New
Testament. And one's called The Beloved Son, and one of my funniest poems is called House of Cards. But in The Beloved Son, I changed the ending of the parable to allow for a moment of grace when the father comes back to the people who killed his son and kneels outside their walls and forgives them. And they lay down their arms and they come out and they kneel together, and the act of forgiveness itself is a huge moment of grace, that we can transcend our bitterness and our anger and frustration, and move toward love and reconciliation. Through a moment of grace is when two people who have not loved one another are able to say, to move past their differences and achieve a new closeness. That's a moment of grace. Here you go. I'll read you. This is the epigraph.
Tony, you need to read quickly.
I'm going to read very, 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 very short. Here's the epigraph to part three. Most tears are grace. The smell of rain is grace. Loving somebody is grace. Have you ever tried to love somebody? This is from Frederick Buechner. So, I mean, it is. I mean, well, rain is grace. I have a poem called You Rain.
Tony Abbott's been talking to us about two books, What Writers Do, but in this segment about his new book of poetry, If Words Could Save Us. And the new book will be subject of discussion at the Regulator Bookstore on this Wednesday. And Tony Abbott, I hope we can get you back up here sometime soon to continue our conversation.
Thank you very much, DG.
Thanks to Tony Abbott. Thanks to all of, thanks to you for listening. And I'll be right back here with Who's Talking before we meet.